What's up, everybody? Welcome back into another episode of Cult Film Cafe. Of course, it is me, one of your hosts, Jonathan. And as always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Kenzie.
Hello there.
It's actually better because he's right next to me.
Oh my God. I've not been here in person since, what, the first episode, maybe? So, like, about a year. So that's
about a year ago. But we're in the same room.
Yep.
So apologies if the audio is worse or better. If it's better, thank God.
Hopefully.
Oh, hopefully. But yeah, got an exciting one. This is a big, big one off the list. So on this episode, we will be talking about the 1992 neo-noir crime thriller Reservoir Dogs, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino.
Hey, your names, Mr. White. Mr. Blonde, Mr. Pink.
Why am I Mr. Pink?
Who cares what your name is?
Yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're Mr. White. You have a cool-sounding name.
Let's go to work.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
What happens if the manager won't give you the diamonds?
Cut off one of his fingers. The little one.
I'm so scared in case I fall out of the chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
If they hadn't done what I told them not to do, they'd still be alive.
It's so hard to keep the smile from my face. I'm all over the place.
You're acting like a first-year fucking thief. I'm acting like a professional.
And your friendly slap you on the back and say,
choice you've been doing 10 years. Taking out some stupid motherfucker. Ain't no choice at all.
Bam.
Bam. Bam, 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 bam.
You're under arrest, sugar.
Harvey Keitel, Michael Madsen, Chris Penn, Steve Buscemi, Lawrence Tierney, and Tim Roth. They're the Reservoir Dogs.
Hey, Joe, I'm gonna shoot this guy.
So, yeah, finally, QT off the list, number one. We're doing them in order because that's what Kenzie suggested. We've got another couple.
Yeah.
To go, but
I wonder if you can guess which ones would be.
You probably can.
One of them, definitely. But yeah, there we go.
Possibly both of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, Reservoir Dogs, probably my favourite Quentin Tarantino film. It's my favourite Quentin Tarantino film.
It's not mine. Mine's is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but like usually, like, I mean, people always like talk about the first two kind of Quentin Tarantino films, Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. I think most people, I mean, not a lot of people, it's kind of like the majority probably say that Pulp Fiction is the best film, but I know quite a few people who'd say otherwise. Like, Jonathan, I'm pretty sure my dad's on, like, the fence. I think my brother does prefer Reservoir Dogs. I'm not entirely sure. But I've always liked the film. It was never, like, one of my favourites, and I hadn't watched it for a while. And so I got a chance to watch it recently because I've been buying steelbooks. So I got a Pulp Fiction steelbook for my birthday. And I was like, you know what? I should see if I can get a Reservoir Dogs one. I could. And so I watched Reservoir Dogs again. And I was like, oh yeah, okay, that's way better than I remember it being. There's like so many things that I knew the film, but there's just certain things. Like, I forgot how short it was. Like, I mean, I just watched like Pulp Fiction like multiple times. Pulp Fiction is really fucking long. It's, I think, maybe QT's longest film. I think it's longer than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Whereas this is like, what is this? An hour 40?
No, about an hour 40, but that's credits included, so.
And it feels really fast paced. It's like, this isn't a complaint. I actually kind of like this. Not much like kind of happens in it. And because of that, all the parts in it get a lot of time to it. So it's like, you're like an hour in, like the whole stuff with like Mr. Blonde and that is done. You're kind of onto like the final little bit of the film. I forgot how this film was structured. Like, I didn't realise when certain parts happened. I didn't know, like, most of the start of the film is shown, like, right near the end before you get to the climax of the film, which I didn't remember. I thought it was much earlier. I guess it's one of the first films to be kind of almost chopped up a little bit, and this became, like, kind of QT's kind of thing, and other people have kind of started to using it. I guess used a lot in cinema now, but he was probably one of the first ones to kind of start properly doing it. I think Pulp Fiction is more known for doing it, but I think this one does it more like other films do it now. I think Pulp Fiction is a bit different. But yeah, revisiting this one, it's fucking great. It's aged great. I mean, what a first film. Yeah. I mean, if you don't count the other one, like, Jesus, it's insane.
I think when you're talking about the way that it's chopped up, so I would say that Pulp Fiction's, it is non-linear, but it's like interwoven storylines, whereas this is just a film that's been chopped up. If you know, like, you see a bit of present and then it goes back, but the way they do it is you go back and it's a bit of history on each of the sort of main four characters and how they get recruited, essentially, is what happens in the sort of flashbacks. But no, I really enjoy it. Great Steve Buscemi. Oh, I love Steve Buscemi in this film. So good.
He is kind of standout. He's like the one that kind of stands out the most, I feel like. Him and, yeah, and Michael Madsen, probably.
Well, Tim Roth originally was reading for Mr. Pink, but ended up with Mr. Orange.
Right choice.
But because he wanted to do Mr. Orange, because he was like a British actor, being an American, being a cop. There was like multiple layers for him. Because obviously, as a British actor and doing an American accent, don't know how good his American accent is, but he's kind of weird. This film's crazy because I wonder if it was shot, if it was genuinely him lying there for all that time, or if it was a body double, because he's genuinely just on the floor not moving for about half an hour.
I wonder, because I think it might have been, because I saw other films that kind of do it. Saw does it with, well, I can't remember his name, Tobin Bell or whoever it is that is.
Oh, like when he's already in the room.
Yeah. But yeah, that guy, that actor, literally, like, seven, like, cause it was really fast filming, like seven of, like, the 8 days he worked was all him just lying on the floor. So maybe they just done it with Tim Roth as well. I mean, I guess it'd make sense. He's probably there, but I don't really know. I mean, how long does it take to shoot?
Yeah, 5 weeks, I think.
That's pretty
cool. It's like 30 days. I think it's a 30-day shoot. I think a lot of these films at this time were like around about four or five weeks. But it's the way that the warehouse sort of scenes are filmed, because for the most part, it's like handheld. And you can tell that, I mean, it's kind of strange because Quentin Tarantino's in this, but he gets killed like really stark, and which kind of makes sense because
he's a director,
and I don't know how much he would have had an influence on camera. Obviously he does, like, I don't know if he'd done any shooting or not, but when they're in the warehouse you can really tell it's just somebody walking about with like a small handheld kind of rig, and it's just kind of moving. There obviously is like other camera placements, but it's kind of strange because you never ever see them. It's the way people film things. Obviously, you position things out of shot, but it's quite interesting when you have a scene that's very fluid that way, where it is like somebody just following you around, and it's like, but you never see like anything that's not meant to be there. It's quite an interesting step. I suppose that's what makes these independent, small budget films interesting to watch, because it isn't like big set pieces and like with multiple cameras and stuff like that. It is, they've got to think more about it, you know. I mean, this is probably the kind of film that's most related to something like Sex, Lies and Videotape in terms of how small it was, independent cinema, how it was shot, how quickly it was shot. Really genius way to do something with not a lot of money. And it would be interesting to kind of know how much of the money went to actors, because I'm sure that Harvey Keitel got a hold of the script. Because I think originally Quentin Tarantino's plan was to just shoot it himself, like save up money and do it like his own production. But obviously it wouldn't, I don't know how good it would have been. But I'm sure whoever, somebody that he knew, I don't know 100%, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but he kind of asked him, like, can you give him a few weeks to sort of put it about? And then eventually it got to Harvey Keitel, who signed on so that the film would get money, like an actual budget to be made.
I mean, Harvey Keitel, like, if it wasn't for Harvey Keitel, this film, I don't think it would ever have got made. I mean, he pushed this thing, like, real hard. Like, I mean, Quentin Tarantino didn't have money to do, I mean, he was a video store, like, they worked in a video store.
Video Archives.
Yeah.
It's the name of his podcast.
And so, once Harvey Keitel got on board, he clearly liked it, and pretty much he was getting, he needed to get Quentin Tarantino out to where all the places he needs to go, but Quentin Tarantino didn't have the money, so Harvey Keitel done that all kind of for him, from what I heard, because he just liked the script that much. And then, at some point, I think Steve Buscemi was the next to get involved.
So Steve Buscemi, Michael Madsen very quick, and obviously Tim Roth. And once you've kind of got the sort of main people locked in. But yeah, I'm kind of glad that it got funded. I mean, a relatively small budget though. I mean, like, what, we like $1.5 million or something.
I wonder how that guy got it to Harvey Keitel. That's quite crazy.
Well, between 1.2 and 1.3 million that was the budget of the film.
That's so small, especially like for the time. That's like tiny.
That is, but I just think that...
And what he done with it as well.
I sometimes think smaller budgets, what? This is, we were off topic, but we were talking about James Wan the other day, that me and Kenzie just, and I called, and I think you were bringing up the Insidious films,
yeah,
and just how much money they've made relative to their budget. And it's because it's just the way the filmmaker is, it's like, the first Saw movie was like...
It was $1 million.
$1 million, incredible. Like, just... He's got a knack, James Wan, of just being able to make money. And it actually is, like, made sense outside of his horror world, because Aquaman's the highest grossing DCU film.
I mean, like, love horror films or not, you can't lie that James Wan isn't a great director.
No, yeah, I agree.
And his story is quite similar to kind of Quentin Tarantino's. Like, he was straight out of film school, came up with Saw, we're going to make it himself, and then someone's like, oh, no, wait, let me, like, show this about. And I think, I can't remember who it was, to go look at it, but they actually liked it that much. It was filmed, like, literally, it wasn't even a month later the film was already getting shot. It was that quick.
Yeah, like, he had a partner, like, Lee Winnell, like, yeah. they kind of done a lot of stuff together, like, writing-wise, whereas Quentin Tarantino really seems... He's a lover of film, and you can see that in his films, where he pays a lot of homage to sort of things, and he's got his own versions of sort of films or genres that he would have liked to have tapped into, which is quite apparent considering his 10th and final film. I mean, I don't know if you can class it as his 10th film, because it would technically be 11 films, but he's classing Kill Bill as one movie.
Right.
But I think that's him after his next movie.
I think that was the plan, but I don't know what his next film...
It's called The Critic.
What is it?
It's about a film critic. It's like going full circle, eh?
Is it about
us? I doubt it, but it's quite interesting.
Oh,
like,
weird.
How
that's...
He's like,
oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
I don't know. Like, I know it's called The Critic, and I've just kind of heard mumblings about it. Podcasts that I listen to about films, they kind of bring it up, and one of the main ones I watch, they've had QT on, like it's the podcast that does the movie drafts, the big picture. But QT was on the 1994 Mega Movie Draft. He was one of the guests, and he drafted a slate of films. I've always said that it would be interesting to do that concept with a couple of folk and see, pick a year and see what would come out. You know, it's really interesting. I really like the episodes. You've basically got like six categories, and you have to draft a film in each of those categories.
Right.
And you end up with, like, they obviously put a poll out on Twitter, or I think it's now called X, or Instagram, or whatever, Facebook, wherever you would do that stuff. And that's how they rank the winner. But it's interesting to see just how people, like, take the draft. There's been some of the episodes where there's been a definitive number one overall. I think they done a 1975 draft, and like I think everybody would have took the same film.
75? What would that have been?
Jaws.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Everybody would have took Jaws. Like, everybody on the episode's like, it's a definitive number one. I think when they done the 2010 draft, everybody would have took the Social Network one as well.
Right.
Because they all love it. Well, it's a great film.
It's a great film. I think people give it a miss, but they really should watch it.
But it's interesting. Like, you get some of them, but some of the categories are weird, because it's like horror. Like, so you've got one of the guys on it that's really into horror, or a couple of them are really into horror. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's quite interesting to see there, and then you get a wild card one where you get to pick any kind of movie. So that's where, because you've got certain categories you've got to have, and then you've got a wild card where you can pick essentially anything that's come out that calendar year. It's really interesting to see some of the films, because I'm sure they've done like a one where they were drafting horror and they were talking about this is it the Spanish horror film Wreck? Is that what am I making?
Yeah,
that
that's
it. Might have been incredible. Like an incredibly good film.
I've seen the American remake. That's horrendous. But
well, normally when things get remade, they aren't as good. Anyway, we went off on a wee tangent just talking about film. But no, I could wax lyrical about this film. Like, it's got the iconic Steeler's wheel, which is such, even to this day, such a good scene. I really enjoyed it.
I mean, you can't listen to the song without like wanting to cut someone's ear off. Like, it's like that. I mean, it's so, like, you cannot like split them apart now. You hear the song, you think of the film. You think of the film, you think of the song. It's the same with Little Green Bag at the start of the film. Yeah. It's just made two songs like super. I mean, Steeler's wheel was like a, I think that song was a big song, but like, it's just made two songs like even bigger and like will be remembered and always attached to this this film.
Yeah, I went to karaoke like the day after I watched this film, and I sung Steeler's Wheel. That was my song of choice. It was just stuck in my head. But yeah, this film is a bit bizarre though, because it's overacted quite a lot.
Yeah,
like, and I think it's just the people that are in it more than anything. But I suppose that's where kind of Michael Madsen just being
so calm,
and he's like, just so calm about everything, man.
Yeah, he's so good. Yeah, it's kind of, I kind of spot this, it's somewhat kind of overacting, especially like Harvey Keitel at certain points I noticed it the most, which I was like, wow, I didn't really remember it being like that. But I guess that was kind of like maybe it was what he was going for with it.
Yeah, he got duped like so easily as well, and you're thinking that Mr. Orange was not the rat, even though he was the rat.
And he's like so.
It's like they were like friends.
But how long had they?
I know, how long had they known each other? It's like, strange.
It's like they're like almost brothers at the end of the film. But I know, I mean. I kind of get Mr. Blonde was an absolute nutcase. So for him to be like, do you know what? I can believe that because I saw what he was at the bank. But once he said like true fact, like, oh wait, he would have Mr. Blonde would have never have done that to them.
Never ratted.
Never ratted. Because
he had the opportunity before and he never.
Never did.
So. It's kind of strange. It's like, but he is a bit mental. But then he's got a point. He's like, if they never done what we asked them not to do, I wouldn't have shot them. I mean, he is a fucking bad cunt. He's a bank robber, do you know what I mean? Who's already done time. It's like, it's strange. I mean, obviously a bit mental.
I mean, the film's kind of fucked from the start. Because the police were already there. It was already set up. The only reason the whole shootout and the police happened is because Mr. Blonde started firing guns and killing people, which caused the police to have to interfere then, which just makes everything go to shit. And but it was going to end bad for them anyway. But
I want to know how Quentin Tarantino, I can't remember. I only really remember four of the colours.
Oh,
is there Mr. Brown?
So there's Mr. Brown's Quentin Tarantino.
And then the old guy.
He's an actual bank robber or something in real life. Mr. Blue.
He's Mr. Blue. So they're only in it very, very briefly.
Mr. Blue does hardly, I don't even think he hardly says a word. QT, all his dialogue is pretty much at the start of the film. When it's then the camera's like spinning around. I love that part of the film, by the way, the start. Just how it just sits and it's just before the heist is happening, it's just going around and they're just having a conversation. It goes on for quite a while. I mean, it's what, again, Quentin Tarantino is known for.
Is this in the coffee shop?
Yeah.
Right. He's good scene. And then a good opening scene, and then eventually you get to the credits scene where it's like the slow mo of them walking with their suits on. And then
to shit.
The music, then the shit, it just hits the ground running. But it's kind of strange when you see the flashback and Quentin Tarantino's driving the car and he's clearly took a bullet to the head, but he's still alive. About 2 minutes afterwards. And it's not until they look back in the window, it's like, oh, he's dead, isn't he?
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting because at the start when you like White and Orange are in the car and it's that's a fucking mad scene where he's bleeding out because he took a shot to the stomach, which when you get further into the film and you see the flashback, you realise it's not what you probably thought happened to him.
Yeah.
It's like a wee old lady that's just got it's a gun because they're trying to carjack him and just gets a shot off.
Gets a shot off and he shoots her in the head.
You're going to be okay. It's like, that's mental. They're like chanting away. Yeah. It's like,
some parts of the film are almost comedic, like parts like that. Yeah. It's just kind of... Also, one thing I didn't remember, well, I knew how it ended, but I didn't realise it's the sudden end. It's bang, bang, credits. Straight.
I want to know if there's other, like, cuts of this film, or if there is only one cut.
I don't know.
Because normally if a film's got multiple cuts, if you go onto the Wikipedia page, it will tell you. This has got one length, it's 99 minutes.
I mean, I was...
But when I was reading the plot, it's like... They obviously, there was like a Mexican standoff between the three of them. They all fire. And basically, they all get killed. Well, White kind of struggles. And then that's where... But apparently, like, there's... Pink takes the diamonds and flees. And then he's heard off screen having an altercation with the police.
I think... I didn't see... That's what I always remember, but I didn't really hear it.
I'm pretty sure
he's may get killed at that moment or something.
And then White... And Orange have the whole, like, where Orange tells him he's a policeman. I can't remember that either.
I don't know why. I was speaking to my brother because he caught the last part of the film, and I was like, why does Mr. Orange at this point
confess?
Well,
he's going to die, that's probably why.
I mean, I don't think I think he was still probably...
Well, then the police storm the warehouse, apparently. I can't remember that either.
Aye,
and then gunshots are like, and White collapses.
Aye, because they bust in, he's got the gun to Mr. Orange, and he just shoots, and then he gets shot, and that's it.
They just cut.
Just cut. Boom, boom. Credits. Like, instantaneously. It's almost... It's not like... It's so fast, it's almost slightly comedic. In a way.
It's the same way as the film opens, though. You get to after the credits and it's boom, straight into action.
Yeah.
And this is like... Everybody's bang, bang, bang. Like, you've just had a Mexican standoff, then there's like a wee bit of lull, then it's kind of the same again. Bang, bang, and then credits. Yeah, it's kind of known for that, though. Like, his films do kind of end that kind of way quite a lot of the time.
I mean, yeah.
He probably writes it that way, like.
Yeah, I mean, this whole film's like quite. I mean, at the time, the effects was quite unique. I think the whole point was he wanted to write a film that no one's seen. I think that's like kind of my thing. He wanted to see the aftermath of a heist gone wrong instead of a heist gone wrong. You know what I mean? Or like the actual heist. So you don't see it. Pretty much don't see any of it. It all takes place right after when and like that part there, where it's much more kind of dialogue heavy, trying to figure stuff out, and it ends up kind of going crazy. Which is on the kind of same time with Pulp Fiction. With not to be the first two stories, because the first two stories are kind of what you've heard before, but the last story is like following like hitmen through the day, like a day in a life, which you don't like, so you see them through the entire day after they've done their mission. So it's kind of like that. I think it was just something he wanted to do, so he's kind of done it twice now.
It's like kind of weird because like reading about the film is there's a lot of homage to a lot of kind of other films, like Stanley Kubrick's The Killing was one that's a film noir for the mid-50s. This is a big, big sort of influence on this film, and this was sort of Quentin Tarantino's take on a heist movie, but done from a different perspective. He also had the colours, that was that kind of aspect of like the Mr. Pink, White, and Brown, etc., was in the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 in 1974. So yeah, you've always got that. Like, this is the thing about Quentin Tarantino films is like a lot of folk, like he's so unique as a filmmaker, but a lot of these films aren't, I wouldn't call them rip-offs, but they are influenced heavily, heavily by cinema history. Like all of them. Like maybe not like Kill Bill, but even Kill Bill probably is to an extent. It's like
absolutely. Like there's literally parts in nearly every Quentin Tarantino film, he's literally took a shot for shot out of something else. I think the one that comes to my head is in Django when he shoots the guy and the blood sprays onto the floors. I think that's taken straight out of something else. I think Kill Bill's got a couple of them as well, and so does Reservoir Dogs. A lot of them do.
Yeah, I mean, I think like Reservoir Dogs is funny. It was like his first film that people seen, and then very quickly after that, like a couple of years later, you get Pulp Fiction, which is kind of deemed his best film. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. And then the next film after that is a film that's slept on, in my view, Jackie Brown, but that's kind of Quentin Tarantino doing like a...
Blaxploitation, kind of.
Aye, it mixed with like kind of crime. It's kind of crime. I mean, a lot of these films are crime, and then he does like a samurai film, then he does like a mental maniac driver killer film in Death Proof, which I actually quite like.
So good. People need to watch that. Like, a few people, that and Jackie Brown, like, if there's, if Quentin Tarantino ever had cult films, they'd be the ones that I would say you should probably watch them. I didn't even know Jackie Brown existed until, like, I got told about it.
I remember having it in VHS when I was growing up. It used to sit in the VHS cabinet. It's kind of with the black and yellow writing, the black cover, yellow writing. But then he's done a Western.
He's done quite a few.
Like, he's done it, well, I mean,
like, if you talk about...
Like a genre.
All right.
But I would call Hateful Eight a Western. I'd call Django, like, his take on, like, there's Django films for, like, the
70s. Oh, that's true.
They were, like, a homage. And then he'd done, like, the Hateful Eight, which is kind of like a Western.
I mean, there's kind of, is it Kill Bill Volume 2 as well? It's kind of Western-y as well.
Yeah, he's obviously influenced by a lot of different things, which makes him a filmmaker that has garnered a lot of fans. I think the problem with him is because he's very, very violent in nature in terms of what he does in a film, there's obviously going to be people that aren't into his movies, like, which I suppose, like, I wouldn't necessarily call him a controversial figure. Like, there's been some weird things about him come out, like, mostly the biggest ones for me is a Kill Bill production, but we'll speak about that on the Kill Bill episode. That's the strangest bit about him. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think because it's a lot of these films are super violent, like, and this one, you get to kind of see things, man. Like, honestly, but see, when I watched this, like, for the podcast, again, there's a terrible, terrible special effect, but which was quite jarring. And it's when the cop that was being tortured, like, he's turning and you see behind his head and he's talking to him. Mr. Orange, it just looks really weird, but it's obviously because it's a fake head, because he's not got an ear. But then when you see like the kind of open frame and it's him from the front, it looks really cool. It's only that one where it's behind him from his point of view and he's talking, it looks really, really weird. I don't know why that's kind of happened, but like I've discussed in many films, there's normally one scene that if you freeze frame stuff, it looks really dodgy.
Yeah.
John Wick was the big one for me. That's a fucking weird scene at the fountain. Anyway, it just kind of felt like that. Like, but obviously, we're talking about a film that's 30 years old. And
speaking of like that kind of scene, the kind of torture scene part, I mean, that was always, that was a kind of big controversy, I think, at the time. I think Harvey Weinstein, I mean, this man's came back in it again, but he wanted to actually cut that from the film, and Quentin Tarantino was thinking, no, I'm not, and he went, okay. I think Quentin actually quoted him word for word on, I think it was Joe Rogan's podcast, saying that he went, all right, we'll keep it in, just remember it was Miramax that let you do it. But I was watching some deleted scenes on my Steelbook, and they'd done quite a few variations of the cutting the ear. There was one where they did it, so it's like from the kind of back corner, and so you don't see him cutting the ear, but it's like from a different angle. It's not as good, because it's not like the one kind of shot like thing you got from, but you actually get in the film, which is way better than the both alternatives. And the other alternative, you actually do get to see the ear get cut off, but it's like a close-up of the ear getting cut off, which I think if they cut in between that would look really quite horrific. But since you got the whole thing, I even gave you a warning before when you picked it on, it does look a bit fake. But yeah, well, they actually
look fake. I'm not going to cut somebody's ear off, do you know what I mean?
I mean, like, the fact that they almost, like, probably almost put that, they actually did film the actual ear getting cut off, stuff like that. But I'm glad they went the way they did, because I think it's a much better way to do it. You don't need to see it. You don't.
It's like, it's all the kind of daft things afterwards, because, like, Mr. Blonde's, like, playing with the ear. Like, yeah. That's the one thing you get to, not only have you kind of watched them cut an ear, but you can see the actual ear that's been removed, and he just kind of throws it away. Like, yeah. It's trash. It's kind of... I don't know if the petrol was needed. Like, I mean, that, like, I understand like the controversy, like violence against police would have probably been quite a... Especially at that time in the 90s, where there was a lot of kind of uprising in, you know, in America, like not long after this or around this time, you know, we had the Rodney King thing, and there was a lot of like... if you know about that, like, you know, like police brutality against blacks, and it was like people like fighting the police. It's happened more recently, obviously, but yeah. It kind of happened in the 90s, and I think there's a lot of cinema like this where people cite it as like because of its violent nature that it obviously didn't help matters. But I mean, I'm one for saying that things like cinema and like TV shows and video games don't spark violence in people. You know, it's they're made for, like, it's totally fictional, you know, like this stuff would have probably happened irrespective of what films were made at the time, you know, because I think like American History X has got a bit of that about it, you know, after the whole things in the early 90s, and then like 4 or 5 years later you get this kind of neo-Nazi kind of white supremacy film, which is actually a really good film and has got a really good moral story in it, like when you see his character grow. That's what really pisses me off about people with American History X, is I don't think if they've ever watched it, they actually know what kind of film it is. It's more about him becoming something else, like, and seeing these flaws and growing, and him trying to save his brother who, yeah, was on the wrong path. And it is quite a harrowing kind of film, but it's not just a neo-Nazi film. That's what makes it good, I think. There's kind of layers to the plot. But, like, this is a bit different. I don't know if it's got, like, layers to it. I mean, it's a very simple film, but done really well. I didn't know that, like, you'd be surprised. George Clooney read for a part for this movie. I don't know how that would have worked, knowing who George Clooney is now, but... I mean, 1992 George Clooney. This is before ER and everything.
Yeah, that wouldn't even.
I don't know.
Who was he?
I don't know. Just say they read for a part. John Cryer. You know who John Cryer is?
Oh, he's Two and a Half Men.
He read for Mr. Pink.
I think it could have worked.
He backed out of the project, so he was obviously cast, and then he left the project.
I think he would have worked, honestly, to be honest. And who knows if he actually done that? Maybe that actually would have took his career in a complete different direction. But yeah. He never did. And luckily Steve Buscemi got it, which I still think Steve Buscemi was, I mean, it's hard to say when you've already seen one performance and you've not seen the other. I think he was still probably the right choice for it, but that would have been interesting. I actually think it would have worked. It would be interesting. It's funny when you think of, like, oh, a recast, like, oh, that can, how much would that change the film and stuff like that, but you always get these what-ifs and stuff like that, because, yeah, I mean, it's like the same in, like, Pulp Fiction, that Michael Madsen was meant to be Vincent Vega, but then of course, John Travolta got the part and stuff like that instead.
Well, so he's Vic Vega in this film.
So he played Vic Vega in this film. He was going to play, well, I don't know if he was going to be called Vincent Vega, but he was going to play that.
Yo, do you know that there's a theory that Pulp Fiction's a prequel to this film?
I don't know if it was a prequel, but I was pretty sure that they're set in the same world just because they have got the same.
Yeah. Thing.
But I think you can say that for almost all Quentin Tarantino films, because certain things like Red Apple Cigarettes always turn up, but I think those ones are like performed.
These two films are as close to sequel, prequel, or same universe as you'll get in QT. After it, it kind of goes like Jackie Brown's kind of more real worldy, and then it gets a bit out of hand with like Kill Bill and Death Proof, and then you get like Django and Hateful Eight, which I don't know. Like the QT verse, I don't really know how it works, but yeah. It is interesting, like when you see just some of the actors that are sort of slated to be in films like this. I think, the film never done massive box office numbers, obviously. I mean, I think it done about 3 million.
Did that actually do that good?
No, well, I mean, it's probably good for an independent film.
I suppose that's kind of triple
the budget, but like, I think the thing is like when you're an independent film, these films are the sort of stepping stones to a bigger career. So like, yeah, they go to like Sundance and then they get really like critics love it and people in the industry love it, and that's how he ends up going from this film to a Pulp Fiction,
which I think was like 8 million.
But then it done like $250 million in the box office.
Won so many awards and everything. Yeah. But I guess that's how you do it. You got to get a real, make a good independent film. It doesn't have to make it the biggest amount of money, but as long as it's like very critically acclaimed. I wonder if that will happen with like the those two YouTube directors that have came out. They've got their horror film that's just came out, and then that was like a kind of very low independent budget film, and now they're getting into kind of possibly getting into action films now and stuff like that. I think that's probably the best way to do it. If you can make a good independent film and get a lot of people behind it, then who knows, further down the line you might get better. You might actually get a quite good career out of it.
Yeah, like what I was saying, like, it was going to originally shoot the film for $30,000 on a 16mm camera in black and white.
Kind of similar to, there's a film he done before, it wasn't, people would deem this his first film. There was a film that he did before this that he did do like that. It was black and white. It was his first attempt, and he was like, he knows it wasn't very good. He learned a lot from that because of that, I think, going into this, especially managed to actually get like some money. Like, to him, that was probably a huge amount. To anyone, when you first started, like in $1 million budget, like think of it, if someone gave you $1 million right now to make a film.
100%. Like, I totally agree with that.
Like here's just Harvey Keitel and Steve Buscemi.
Right. I think that's the biggest thing, is not only did you get secure funding, you got a name that people know. Like, Harvey Keitel isn't, like, I think he's a known actor, but I don't think he's, like, fucking, like, mega famous, but he's famous enough.
It's been about for a while.
That's what I'm saying. He's famous enough that it's good to have somebody like that. And then obviously what he'd done is he took some shots, but he found these other actors who before this probably weren't really famous, you know.
I mean, Tim Roth,
Steve Buscemi, Michael Madsen. I can't really remember them in anything before this. Like, I think Steve Buscemi has went on. He's probably the sort of bigger one. He's done fucking.
He's done tons. I'm surprised about his career. I don't know why, but Tim Roth doesn't need to be as much. I know he was in like things like Tin Star, but I saw the first series of that and I was not a fan. But like Steve Buscemi's in tons of stuff. He's had such a good career.
Like before, like the year before this, he was in Barton Fink. He was also in Miller's Crossing. He's worked with the Coen brothers. But they were like small parts. It's like he wasn't like a part. I think a part like this kind of.
Who was he in Barton Fink again?
Jet, the wee waiter, busboy.
Oh, he was hardly.
Jet.
Yeah,
Jet. Like that. Okay, he's hardly in it.
Hardly
in
it. Yeah.
He's just so recognizable as a feat, like facial wise. Like
absolutely.
There's only one Steve Buscemi that looks like Steve Buscemi. You know, it's Steve Buscemi.
There's only one film I didn't recognize him in, and that was Pulp Fiction. He plays the waiter.
Ah, he does.
But
don't
you don't. He's such a tiny, tiny role that you could not realize it was him because he's got glasses on and that. Yeah. And it's hard to tell.
Strange.
I don't know why he did that, but it is him, which is insane.
But obviously, he was looking for all these kind of small parts that in good films. Like, it's quite a smart way to be.
The Coen brothers took him back and then done what, like Big Lebowski, right? So. I mean that, and I mean he's had shows, Boardwalk Empire, which is amazing. There's others, just so much.
Oh, he's massive, like Steve Buscemi, like now, looking back. But at the time, obviously not. But yeah, low budget, yes.
Yes.
I mean, I wouldn't really necessarily call it a flop. It probably isn't the type of film that
it's you're not fair.
It's not a fair comment. It's not that type of, like, this kind of independent cinema of this time wasn't made to make loads of money. So, like,
yeah.
But still, I would still call it, like, low budget. I mean,
did it win any awards? I don't know if it did. I mean, it might have. I can't really remember. I know Pulp Fiction won, like, tons, but, like.
Pulp Fiction did.
They were both in Sundance, I think.
This was screened out of competition at the Cannes Film Festival in 1992.
Oh, right.
But yeah, like, Pulp Fiction was the one.
Yes.
But, I mean, I don't think you get a Pulp Fiction
without this. Absolutely not.
It's kind of one of these weird ones. This film's so rewatchable, man. It's so short. Like, it's so fast-paced. I think the non-linear narrative style works so well for it.
Yes.
Because you're not kind of stuck. I think the reason it works for me is because the budget's so low, and I think, like, when you want to do a heist movie, if you were to do it like a whole heist movie and include the heist, I think that's where a lot of money would be involved, like robbing a bank and all of that stuff. Whereas what Quentin Tarantino done was like, oh, I'm going to say that I'm robbing a bank, but then I'm going to show all the aftermath stuff, which is a lot cheaper to film.
Yeah.
Because it's basically one, like running about streets.
Yeah.
Like the in-car stuff with like white and orange in a big warehouse, which is really the only locations. But then what he does really well with the sort of flashbacks is he goes to other locations, which kind of opens up the world a bit. Because it's not like you get to see the office, like with Mr. White coming out of jail, that's one. But then you've got Orange, who's in a diner with his partner. It's like these kind of, just different places. It just takes you away for a bit. Because I think these kind of small budgets, if it's all in the one location, can feel a bit stale quickly. But no, yeah. This film definitely doesn't. So yeah, I mean, critically acclaimed, I don't think there's anything much more to say about it. I mean, the film currently holds, it's only got an 8.3 in IMDb, which I think is really low. Roger Ebert gave it 2.5, but I think probably a lot of violence and shit probably put him off.
Really?
I'm a big Empire magazine fan. Before we started recording, I let Kenzie see all my new ones for this year, where I've got like different art covers, which is really cool. But Empire gave it 5 stars, which I agree with. I'm not going to lie, I think this is a 5-star. Rotten Tomatoes is a 90% fresh and a 94% audience score. So yeah, like across the board, realistically, like massively, like critically acclaimed film. So yeah, it is well received in that sense. It's a quotable film as well, but the problem is I can't remember. I see if we'd recorded the day after.
Yeah.
Like we should have. I would have remembered a lot more. But there is like,
I've got a couple.
There is some standout lines which I can't, off the top of my head, it's taken me a while. Yeah. Go on, Kenzie. Hit us with them.
So the two that I always remember, always the main one. Actually, there's three. Sorry, I forgot the Mr. Vaughn one. So there's a Mr. Pink at one point. It goes, why'd I gotta be Mr. Pink? Because it's the start of the film, but it's near the end of the film. That's always a big one. I think gets heard a lot. There's Mr. Blonde's, are you going to bark, little doggy? Are you going to bite? And that's a good line. It's so good.
The problem is he's so calm in the film, and it's the way he delivers it, because he's just standing with his fucking shades on, sipping a cola, because he's obviously went for a Mackey's, you know. He just doesn't care. Like, yeah. I think it's because he's been in that environment. So before, like, he's just so calm about it all.
Like, he says it twice, like, straight after, and even the second time, it hits just as hard. Maybe even harder than the first time he did it. It's just so good. The other one is near the end of the film, and it's Sean Penn's character. He's like, oh, stop pointing the gun at my dad. Which he says just before fucking all the guns go off. I always remember that line. I don't know why, but that's another one
I quite like. So you were talking about the dialogue, like the one that's the scene that's heavy dialogue at the start.
I love it. Probably my favourite part of the film.
This is the part where, like, they're talking about Like a Virgin.
Yeah.
The song. And it's fucking mad. Like, Quentin Tarantino is strange.
Because he's strange. So strange, you can have like things like this and these weird kind of dialogues that are very good. And this is where Quentin Tarantino gets to do his character. Which is really kind of being himself, but not kind of ish.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's kind of funny. This is this is another line that I did remember, like now, like looking at it. It's like another one from the diner scene. And it's like Mr. Blondes asks Joe, do you want me to shoot this guy for you? And Mr. Wright says, shoot me in your dream. You better wake up and apologize. They've got like a bit of. Like, they want to be in charge, both of them. They've got the kind of alpha of the group in them. Whereas, like, I mean, we don't really see much of Blue or Brown. White and Blonde are, they're like the mains. Orange is a big part of the story, but for the most part, it's just lying, bleeding out for a long period of time. And then you've got Pink. I think what Steve Buscemi does is he offers that kind of break of macho. Because when you look at him, you go, how the fuck is he a bank robber? But I think most groups of like 5 or 6 people probably have a person like that in them. because he's a different character type.
That's quite funny. Like, he always says for the fellas, like, we're supposed to act like professionals. I actually think Mr. Pink's the only person in this film who actually acts like a professional.
No, true.
I think he is the most professional out of all of them, even though he's not very liked. I was there, actually, that Blu-ray had so much like information, like little parts of the character that to add to them to like know a little bit more about them. But yeah, he's like a perfectionist and stuff like that. And I think it kind of shows when shit's going to the fan, he's like, bro, like, stop. Like he always says, act like professionals. Whereas Mr. White's kind of going off on one because he's got a temper. Yeah. Mr. Blonde's insane. Mr. Orange, well, he doesn't really count because he's not really he's just trying to stay alive and do his job. Yeah. That's all he's really there for.
Yep. Also, there's a part also in the coffee shop or what like diner that they're in. I think it's the first time I've ever seen it because you know like the whole. See if somebody's like whining about something and you start doing that and it's like playing the world's smallest violin.
No.
I was like, that's in the film. Because that's what Steve Buscemi says. He's like, do you know what this is? It's like the world's smallest violin playing for the waitress because he doesn't tip. That whole kind of, I don't believe in it. It's like fucking, then they go on a whole tangent about it. And then somebody tries to pull their money out because they actually made them believe that it's right. And then Joe comes back and goes, no, fucking put the money in on the table. And he's like, I'm only doing it because you paid. It's like, yeah.
I wonder who coined that phrase, world's smallest violin. I wonder.
I don't know. Still like, it is a quotable film. There's more. Like, I think, like I said, there's like, it's hard. Like, if I think some of these films, you really, if you watch them and then you go, oh, like, press record, let's talk about them now. And it's some that kind of linger. You get films that have got one-offs or a couple that are standouts that you'll remember forever, but yeah, this film's has got a few. And I like you said, the Mr. Bond one about, are you going to bark all day, little doggy, or are you going to bite? I think so. That's something you would say to somebody if you were having a bit of verbal sort of back and forth.
You wanted to piss someone off a little bit.
Yeah, it's a good line, I think, you know. That is good. So, yeah. So that just kind of leaves us with legacy and controversy.
I mean, I'm not too sure about, like, controversy. I mean, this film's absolutely got a legacy. I mean...
Yes.
It's Quentin Tarantino's first kind of film, and it'll always be remembered. It still stands up. It's amazing. I think some people would probably esteem both Quentin Tarantino never bet his first two films. A lot of people probably agree with that. I disagree, but most people probably do think that's where the start of his career was his best of his career, and he's only got worse. A lot, that's kind of a common thing. A lot of people
I don't think he's got worse. I think he's got a couple of films that aren't really for me, and then I think he's just on a same level. I don't think there's like, I think he's a director that if you like. I think I said this on the kind of Coen Brothers thing, and it's not that he's culty or anything like that. That was my own thing, but I think there's a certain level of name value that means that his films are never ever totally bombs, and critics never totally destroy him. Yeah. You know what I mean? He's like, he's got that certain level of kudos that everything is at least there, and then he has films that kind of elevate. So, you know, I would say a film like this, Pulp Fiction, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But all these films are kind of different. I think what Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has that a lot of his other films don't is like technology gets better, and I think he's becoming a better filmmaker.
I mean, the shots in that film are just fantastic.
So I think that's the problem. But I think what if you compare something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood to a Pulp Fiction, I think I like Pulp Fiction's uniqueness and originality more. I think there's other directors that could make a Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I don't think there's a lot that could make a Pulp Fiction. And I think that's the biggest mark against some of the films. I think if he's being uniquely him, I prefer the films. And as much as I'm not a massive Quentin Tarantino like Stan, I wouldn't call him one of the best directors or one of my favourites, but he's definitely up there. Like he's got certain films that I really love, certain films that I like, and then there's some where I don't really feel one way or the other. But I don't think I could have him off like a top 15 list of directors for me. He would be on that.
Absolutely.
maybe even a top 10.
I think,
but
I
I've got directors that I prefer personally over him.
See, I would never I saw this like little poll on YouTube at one point. I was like, oh, which one out of these choices, which one's your like favorite kind of director? And I don't know what my favorite director is. I need to really think about that. Quentin Tarantino is up there, but I would never deem him my favorite. And I wonder who I would. He's a director I've seen every single one of his films.
I bet it's much easier to watch his back catalogue or like a Christopher Nolan's back catalogue when they've got like 7 or 8 films, 9 films or whatever each.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, you want to watch every Spielberg movie. There's probably about 30 of those.
Scorsese's
about 30 of those. It's like these directors in the sort of 70s or 80s were pumping out a film every 2 years or something, you know?
Around the world.
And now Scorsese's slowed right down. Like for the last, I don't know, 10 years, he's been making a film. Like in the sort of 2000s, he was still doing every couple of years, and then you get to The Departed, and then there's like a gap because I'm pretty sure it was like The Departed, then Shutter Island.
Yeah.
So that's a 4-year gap, and then you got Shutter Island to Wolf of Wall Street, which was a 3-year gap, and then a 3-year gap to Silence, which is a slept on Scorsese movie,
and an Irishman, right?
And an Irishman, which was 3 years.
I don't think he's slowed down by
like
that
Killers
much.
Of the Flower Moon, when did Irishman come out, like 2021?
Originally, yeah, I think it was scheduled for like 2021.
What, The Irishman?
The Irishman was 2019.
So, I mean, Killers of the Flower Moon comes out soon, like this, the end of this year.
But he was already working on that while Irishman came out. Yeah. I remember we looked it up and it was already on IMDb.
But that's because the way Scorsese makes movies, it's a lot of practical and on-location shit. He has to be way ahead. Otherwise, it would take him, like, if he had to wait to develop a film after he'd made a film, it would take him 10 years to make a movie.
Yeah.
Because, like, he's got a unique style that's dying. Like, he very rarely uses, like, visual and special effects and CG. Well, I mean, he probably doesn't use CG. And if he does, like, it's de-aging and shit like that. It's nothing like...
Yeah, why would you do that if he can? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And these directors are, like...
They're old school. Yeah.
I think that's why I quite like Quentin Tarantino. He's kind of like a mix. He's kind of like in between old school and new school. And there's a number of directors like that. But you also get directors that can use visual and special effects to their advantage, you know. Like Christopher Nolan couldn't make the films that he makes without that side of the industry.
Absolutely,
but
yeah.
He does it in such a way that's just fucking spectacularly groundbreaking.
He's always had a good mix of it, though. I think that his ultimate is that
it's how he handles it.
Use the CGI visual effects, but use them in the right term. It's the whole point. What everyone always goes on about is you don't just use one or you don't use the other. You use it in a perfect kind of mend. So, like, probably more practical, but then that little help of the visual, and they mix together very well. But don't just go, like, Marvel just, like, focuses straight on this CGI. You can tell.
It's like Star Wars, like, you know, Star Wars all green screen shit and that, and like lightsabers don't exist, and I get that, but when George Lucas, as much as you can flaw the prequel trilogy, he just made miniatures, and like that's a great way to make films. It's like, and then the originals, that's why I like the originals. It's like they're looking at it practically, because yeah, like special effects were in their infancy and they kind of existed and didn't really, but there was always a workaround, and if there was a workaround 50 years ago, it means that there's a workaround now.
Absolutely.
You don't just have to rely on it. It's like mad. It's like you hear stories like Marvel. It's like, what was it? Spider-Man Far From Home. Is that the one with Mysterio in it? Aye.
Yes.
And it's like the scene with Nick Fury, and he sat and he's like, he's got a gun. But it's not a gun.
Whole CGI.
It's a pencil with a tennis ball on it.
Why? Like, who couldn't make the gun?
Well, I don't know. You could get a replica.
Just get something. Like,
that's why I think like there's certain directors that use CG, like the Wachowskis when they made The Matrix, but all those guns were just replicas, man. They've got some amazing action sequences, but they weren't like CGI guns, they were all real.
No.
And it's like there's certain props that you can just have, right? It might not look the same, but I mean, make a replica. Like, I don't understand. It's like, it makes me think, is Captain America's shield real? Or is it just CG and he's just flinging nothing?
It depends on like
it's
what
strange,
scenes,
yeah.
Maybe. Like that could possibly be true.
No, but he must have an actual shield.
They'll have an actual shield, but for certain scenes.
Aye, like obviously when he throws it and it was boomeranging around, obviously CG. But I mean, It would be quite alarming if you found out that the shield doesn't actually exist.
The whole time it was just,
just whatever it was. But that's what CG does.
I just got to the point, I mean, look at fucking Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man suit. It just became completely green screen. Like, what was he like? I wonder, did he have to like have to really wear anything when he was in like Endgame and Infinity War? Because it was just a completely CGI'd.
Aye, the nano suit.
Yeah.
That's weird because he just pulled like a mad ripcord in his tracksuit that he used to wear, and then it would just...
He just got to the point where he's like, I'll just make it all CGI, he doesn't have to do the whole suit. I mean, you look at him in the first film, the suit looks amazing.
Aye, but technology is advanced. This is where we were arguing about superheroes the other night there, but because he's a really clever guy and he's a really technical, smart scientist, dude, he just kept developing technology. So that's how it works. So that matches the technology of CG.
It just makes sense. It
makes sense in the film, but
it does look worse.
It would be mad if they had the old suit, but CG'd it instead of like kind of looking practical.
Yeah.
But no, like off on another tangent. Huge legacy for it. It made Quentin Tarantino, and Quentin Tarantino's just being himself, which is quite refreshing, because you know, like, it's hard to be in this industry and just be so confident about you. But it took him a while to get in.
Yes.
So, like, I mean, he was an extra in like episodes of The Golden Girls and shit as an actor, because I think he probably wanted to be an actor.
Did he not play Elvis at one point or something?
Like, he was an Elvis impersonator in The Golden Girls.
Yeah, that was it. Right. Okay. The gold set.
He had like a big quaff in that. Like, it was weird, strange seeing him. But you can tell he wanted to be an actor because he's been in multiple other kind of films, from Dusk Till Dawn. Like, he's like a major role in that movie.
Yeah.
So it's kind of strange. Like, maybe he's always wanted to do both, or maybe he's an actor that couldn't make it and went, fuck it, I'll write movies.
I mean, he's a great writer of movies.
Or has he been writing films thinking he's going to star in it? Like, this is what Kenzie does for himself. He writes films and goes, I'm playing one of these parts.
I just think it'd be so much fun. I'm quite bad for it. But
you kind of just write and go, right.
I know tons of people actually do. Like, I know Kenneth Branagh does it a lot, but that's just a bit of a...
Oh, he's a pain in the arse.
Ah, exactly.
Because he's just...
It's just too much. I write this, I'm starring. You can't do that for everything. I mean, Quentin Tarantino, I think he clearly likes acting, but I think he knows he's not that good. He's all right. He can get through a film, and he's never like, I don't think all of his like cameos in his films and stuff like that, none of them have felt like so out of place to me that I'm like, takes me out of it.
No,
none of them have, and I think
his style of acting and the way he is like kind of weird and quirky,
very human,
and, like from Dusk Till Dawn, his character in that works because of the type of film that is, but no, yeah.
I think it's worse.
But then obviously you've got things like that. It's like, I'm not saying that Robert Rodriguez wouldn't have made a film, because he would have. Like, I mean, he made El Maharaji as a student project while at film school. But QT and him, they kind of came up at the same time, and a bit of exposure and sort of buzz at the same time. It's like, I think these sort of filmmakers end up with huge legacy because like they're helping each other. Do you know, it's a strange one. But no doubt about it. Like that, like the legacy is easy to sort of see with this film. You don't really necessarily need to go overly above. I mean, like obviously it's never been remade and all that kind of stuff, but it made Quentin Tarantino who he is today. So yeah, I mean, and then controversy. I mean, I don't think it's massively controversial, but I think with a lot of Quentin Tarantino films, there is a tinge of it, you know. It's because of the violent nature. He's quite willing to leave stuff in. But he's also quite smart and he knows what to leave out. So, and I think that's maybe more on the idea of how do I make the most money rather than he wants to. Because I think if he could leave a lot of that stuff in, he would. But he obviously knows that these production companies and distributors are going to be like, I'm not releasing that.
The thing is, compared to probably other people who are starting up, he kind of fights back, whereas others probably don't. I think that's the whole thing, when he got to keep the torture scene in and stuff like that. Like, I think he said himself, he probably would have took it out if it wasn't for the fact he had already seen some screenings of it and knew that it worked well. So, yeah, I mean, just sometimes you do want to stand your ground if you want to keep stuff in your film and stuff like that. Yeah, like I don't think. Let's see, Quentin Tarantino is always the one that's brought up about violence in films. I don't actually think his films are like that. His films are very bloody. I think it's a lot of the effects are just, it's a lot of blood, but it's not. I don't. Especially most of them are not like super gory or anything. There's a couple of ones, I mean, the head in Pulp Fiction, but even that, like, again, it's just mostly just blood.
I think the problem for me is a lot of it's real world shit, and I think that hits more. I think as if it's over the top, it kind of doesn't have the same effect on the audience, do you know?
I guess so.
Whereas if it's something that you could really happen to you. That's why, like, I think horror, gore and stuff like that is a bit fantasyful, because it's not really real. Whereas, I mean, getting shot and getting your ear cut off and tortured, I mean, that's probably happened to somebody.
I guess the tone of it as well.
Aye, the tone. It's like, but the problem is he still straddles that line where you were talking about earlier, where there is still some sort of comedic elements to this film. And it's like straddling that tone makes it work. Whereas super serious, I'm a super serious filmmaker and this is a super serious film and I'm going to torture folk about, I don't know if I'm into that. Because it seems a bit too real. Whereas I think this does get away with it. And I don't think you can not have the torture scene in this film. Like, I can't imagine this film without it.
Yeah.
I don't know what, like, because it's such a big part of the film.
It's the biggest part of the film, really. I don't like, bar like the end. But even though, I think that is the part of the film that stands out overall.
Well, it's what you would call the inciting point. Is that what they call it? What is it?
I was going to call it the money shot again. But
the money shot is definitely not the right term. Oh, I keep forgetting, we learned about it in film theory, it's like the crescendo, it's like the plot gets to a point and then there's like a big inciting point and then it kind of dips. But what happens in this is like he gets so far and he's about to light the guy on fire and then basically Orange fucking unloads a whole fucking round into him. And then that kind of swings the narrative because they come back and go, what happened? And then he tries to swing the narrative and say that he was a rat, blah, blah, blah. He was going to run away, blah, blah. And then you find out, well, actually, he wouldn't because he didn't do it. And then that's really kind of how you get to the Mexican standoff. So, yeah, that's kind of the part of the film where it sort of hits the peak. And then from there, you've kind of got the resolution, which basically every cunt dies. Yeah. Well, everybody that's part of the film, like the police that raid, they all stay alive, but I mean, did Steve Buscemi get shot? Did he get killed?
I don't know if it's fully confirmed.
Because it's off camera.
So people say is you can hear kind of shots or whatnot. I don't know if he actually dies, but
it's not officially.
I think that's a lot of people say that.
Yeah.
But it'll never be confirmed, so you never really know.
True. And that's another one of them use of a J or an L cut, and I can't remember which is which, but it's like you hear the audio, but you don't see the picture. I spoke about it in Sex, Lies, and Videotape because I'd done like, it was a fully researched podcast because I had the bit between my teeth because the film was so great. I wanted to know what was going on. But a J cut and an L cut are just opposites to each other.
One's without audio, one's.
No, no, like, so basically, you hear the audio, but it lingers on the shot before, or the audio. The audio stays from the shot before and it starts the new scene.
So
they're just opposites, you know what I mean?
That's what you mean.
So basically, the new scene audio comes in before the actual picture, like the shot changes.
Right, okay.
And then the flips to that is like...
The opposite way around.
They're basically like opposite cuts from each other, but they're used for an effect, which probably happens quite a lot in films, the more you know about them, like, because there is probably like audio in films where you actually can't see the person. The more you think about it, it's just interesting.
I think a lot of films probably use the sound lingering.
They just kind of tail it off. Anyway, that is it for this episode. But before we go, I suppose we better give it a wee rating and that, and see if where we would put it on a list and all that jazz.
Oh yeah, I mean the
part of the actual point of the podcast.
Yeah. I mean, you want me to go first?
I mean, I think I've already said that. I've already said it's a five-star film. Yeah.
See, I don't know. I've always gave it a 4.5. There's three Quentin Tarantino films I've given 5. I think they were Pulp Fiction, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and probably Django, I think. This one's close. I'm just not too sure if it is 5 stars for me. It's so close. It really is. But I'm probably going to still stay with the 4.5. But it's like, oh, it's almost a 5. I mean, at one point, I'll watch it one more time and I'll be like, all right, it's a 5. It's like that close.
Oh, we're not mile and miles apart. Like, I think it's a 5-star. It's my favourite Quentin Tarantino film. And yeah, there's a lot of things I love about it.
Yeah.
And there's not really a lot of things I dislike about it. So it was pretty easy. I already said it. There's a folk would have known what I was going to give it anyway. Is it a cult movie? This is the hard part.
Ooh,
I think my issue is because it's a Quentin Tarantino movie. Like, I'm going to bring this up. Is there a tinge of cult about Quentin Tarantino? Because he's a director that's famous, but he's always a person that's never spending millions of dollars on a movie and never makes $1 billion at the box office. You know, he has his own audience and niche in this film industry. Spectrum. That is kind of hard, like, you know.
I think people deem kind of Quentin Tarantino's cult. Like, oh, I like cult films like Quentin Tarantino. And I was like, all right, not slow down.
It's hard.
I can understand why, but he's not. He's too big. He's just.
It's hard to take away him from the individual film as well.
He would,
because this is obviously like first film, independent film. I would say this film, if you're going to pick any film of his to be cult, would be this one.
This one. Probably when it came out roundabout would have been probably deemed it, but then of course after Pulp
obviously
Fiction,
what happens, yeah,
because of that
explodes.
Just skyrocketed his career.
It's hard, like it is hard.
I wouldn't deem it a cult film, to be honest, and it just isn't. It's too well known. It's like, yeah, Pulp Fiction is probably even more well known, but they're both pretty much known as well as each other. Mm-hmm. I would probably argue. I mean, is there any Quentin Tarantino film you could deem as kind of cult? Like I said, if there was any to deem...
Death Proof, maybe.
Death Proof or Jackie Brown. There's the two. Probably Death Proof.
Jackie Brown's like a convention. Well, as much as a conventional film as Quentin Tarantino's ever made. So it would probably only really be Death Proof. And it probably is because it was part of that.
People forget about it, yeah.
But it was part of that silly double feature with Planet Terror.
It didn't do very well.
So...
And he even deems it his worst film, which is absolutely not true. I mean, it didn't help that it was a double feature with
And there's multiple cuts of it as well, because he was prompted to make a slightly longer version and then release it itself rather than part of the Planet Terror, whatever it was called.
Grindhouse.
But yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence, like I said. I feel very much about Quentin Tarantino as I feel about the Coen brothers. There's like an air of cultiness about their names because they work in this pocket of space which is never ever, let's make a super expensive movie and bomb. Do you know, like, I think there's a lot of young directors now that are kind of falling into that trap. Like, Damien Chazelle's kind of fell into it with Babylon, where it probably costs a lot of money, and I think there's a lot of people that like it, but I don't think it's his best work, and you've not watched it, I've not watched it, but I think what happened with Tarantino is he's very much stayed in the pocket. What is his most expensive film to date? Like, yeah, what is the film?
I think it's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and it's a big budget. It's like 150 million, 120, or maybe 120 million, maybe. I think that is his most expensive film, though. It's about
140?
90 to 96. Oh, wow.
But the problem is I don't think any of his films really gross more than sort of 300-400 million. Works in that weird pocket. That's what I'm trying to say.
It's a high budget film, but it's not actually that bad for him.
Well, when you think about how much did they pay Leonardo DiCaprio?
How much did they pay Brad Pitt?
25 million. Well, their two proper A-listers would be 20, 25 million.
And even Margot Robbie's getting up there as well.
And if they actually paid them 20, 25 million, that's half the budget just in two people. So when you factor that in, it's not that big a budget considering the film that he made. But no, I'm on the fence. I mean, I could probably sway one way or the other. If I could was to pick one because it is his first film and independent production and stuff like that, then yeah, I think people could deem it cult. For me, I don't really care because irrespective, if it's a cult film, it would be in my top 10. And barring that, even if it's not a cult film, it's definitely making a list of top 100 best films of all time for me anyway. So irrespective, it would make a list of either my favourite films of all time or the best cult films of all time. So it's a win-win.
I mean, yeah.
And I think it all depends on your own perception. I think Kenzie's probably right. Quentin Tarantino is just too famous now. So I think reflectively looking back and 30 years after the film came out, it's probably a lot bigger now. I mean, there's probably loads of people that have watched this, although it never done loads of money at the box office, but I think there's loads of people that have watched this like in the 30 years since it's been out.
I mean, this is probably another one that I'd deem possibly a classic. I probably would call it just a classic, but it's probably Pulp Fiction as well.
Yeah, we're probably starting to get into this sort of era of film becoming classics, just because it's like, I think it's like it's deemed like, I think it's like 25 years and older.
What's that, 30 now?
No, 30. It's like 31.
31.
So yeah, possibly could be a classic. Oh, and I mean, such a good film. Anyway, we've waxed lyrical enough about this fantastic movie that is Reservoir Dogs. So yeah, if you would like to go and support the podcast in any way, please go over and give us a wee follow on Instagram or Twitter. It's at Cult Film Cafe on both of them. And yeah, we are available wherever you get your podcasts. And we hope you enjoy listening. And we will be back with another episode very, very soon. So it's a goodbye from me.
And it is a goodbye from me.
Podcast out. My man.